All right, let's close the eyes. Okay, nice and comfortable spine, but tall. Just relax the shoulders. Let's recite Om three times. Inhale. Open the eyes and we'll do the invocation. So you can either read the screen or just close the eyes, listen in. Inhale. Yogen chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarotam pravaram muninam Patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. Patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. And Karen, you may want to read the English translation.
Sure. I respectfully bow down with folded hands and offer my salutations to Sage Patanjali, the highest among the Munis, sages, who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through his treatise on Ayurveda, of language through his treatise on grammar, and the impurities of the citta through his treatise on yoga.
Just a minute. We have been doing the yamas and niyamas, remember? Mm-hmm. And what we did last time was to go start with the niyamas, and we went through the niyamas, the first three niyamas. Thank you. So just a very quick review of the five yamas and five niyamas. What are the five yamas? Let's go back. What are the eight limbs of yoga, first of all? Let's list those eight limbs. Yamas, niyamas, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana. And samadhi. So one more time, let's make it a little more internalized. Yamas. Okay. Gail, you want to repeat these one more time?
Yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana.
Dhyana.
Dhyana and samadhi.
Samadhi. You want to try them?
Sure. Yamas, niyamas, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, and samadhi.
Very good. Very good. Tejal, do you remember these? Asana, pranayama.
Pranayama,
Before that, dharana. Dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Okay, so these are the eight limbs of yoga. Roughly, everyone knows what these eight are?
Yes.
Roughly, we all know that, right? And then we listed the five yamas. So who wants to go with the five yamas first? We'll try the five yamas? No.
Well, I have an idea. I don't know. I can't recite them.
Who wants to try?
I can read them.
Yeah, I can read them right here.
Okay, go ahead, read them.
Nonviolence, truthfulness.
No, read the English, and along with that, the Sanskrit.
Okay. Nonviolence, satya.
No.
Ahimsa, nonviolence.
Yes.
Sarana, truthfulness. Atterya.
No. What's truthfulness?
Satya.
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 Asteya.
Asteya.
Non-stealing.
Yes.
Brahmacharya.
Brahmacharya.
Brahmacharya. Continent. Aparigraha.
Let me make it aparigraha.
Aparigraha.
Yes.
Non-greed.
Yes. So that's the five yamas. Okay. Karen, you want to repeat them one more time?
Did you repeat this? Okay. Ahimsa, satya, asteya, brahmacharya, aparigraha.
That's it. That's the five yamas. You're okay with them?
I need to read it. I might put it first.
Okay. All right, but you roughly get the idea, right?
Yeah.
So it's nonviolence, truthfulness, number three,
non-stealing. Continent.
Do you know what continent means?
No.
Abstinence.
Oh, okay.
Celibacy.
And non-greed,
yes.
Remembering all the Sanskrit is challenging.
Yeah.
That's what it is, yes. It's challenging, but...
Why is it necessary? I mean, if you know what the English is, why do you need to know the Sanskrit?
It's good to know, because everything is in Sanskrit originally.
Kind of because of what it is.
It's just the way things have been presented to us. And sometimes, you know, even though you do your best effort to translate things into English, there's something always missing between the word and the meaning. Some of the words cannot be translated very perfectly.
Yeah, but if you don't know what it means anyway, what's the difference?
But if you know the original Sanskrit word, there's a chance that you may eventually understand the meaning thoroughly. And then you stay with the Sanskrit word rather than looking for a translation which doesn't convey the exact meaning. Some translations, some words cannot be translated.
Yeah.
So you stay with the original word and then keep trying to understand the essential meaning of those words until one day you understand, and then you don't have to translate them. Because now you understand them, not translate them. So that's why it is important to know the Sanskrit words. Eventually you might use them. In any case, there are some people who claim that Sanskrit words have a certain vibrational energy of their own. So whether that's true or not, I don't know, but many people claim that.
Is that spoken anywhere, or is it really?
Currently it's not spoken, but that movement is reviving now. So there's a lot of people who are learning how to speak, including me. So I've been learning for many years, but now I'm putting a little more effort in terms of speaking it.
Actually conversing.
Conversing in it, yes. But like my teacher, for example, he's as fluent in Sanskrit as he is in English, or his own native language.
So who does he talk to?
Who does he talk to
in Sanskrit?
He does not speak. In the class, he does not speak a single word of English.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And everyone understands.
Okay.
People understand. It's just the challenge is to hold a conversation, to make and hold a conversation. That's where my challenge is.
I'm taking this conversational sense.
She is taking that class.
Yeah. Wow.
It's very difficult because, like you say, the whole class is taught in Sanskrit.
Mm-hmm.
They don't say, now we're going to talk about the verbs. And then they give you no English.
They just start talking.
Yeah. They just start going in Sanskrit.
How are you doing with it?
Well, it's fun. I must admit, all the students are so nice. They all help me. English, you know.
You're probably the only non-Indian there.
Yeah.
No, that movement is catching up now. Even in India, there are many, many people who are learning how to speak, and then there are many people who...
So that's not a language spoken in India, Sanskrit?
No, it's not. Mm-hmm. It's not.
It used to be in ancient times. It's like Latin, when we study Latin,
it's not really spoken.
It's just like the same thing as Latin, but you know, in the ancient time, it was spoken by all the elite people. Then regional languages took over, and now it's only a classical language predominantly. Okay, so then we moved on to the niyamas. What are the five niyamas now?
Saucha.
Saucha.
Santosha.
Santosha. Mm-hmm. Tapas,
Swadhyaya.
Ishvara Pranidhana. Ishvara Pranidhana. Okay, and we covered up to tapas last time. We said we'll start from Swadhyaya today. So we covered the niyamas of Saucha, which is cleanliness, Santosha, which is contentment, and Tapas, which is austerity. And now we are going to talk about Swadhyaya. Okay. So once again, we'll start with the Sanskrit first. So Swadhyayat. Isht Devata Samprayogaha. So Swadhyayat Isht Devata Samprayogaha. Now the word Swadhyaya means study of the self through an understanding of the scriptures. So you study the self and study the scriptures. And when they say the scriptures, they talk about all the ancient texts in India, like the Vedas and Upanishads and Yoga Sutras and Bhagavad Gita and all those texts. Have you heard these terms at all?
Oh, sure.
Okay, you're somewhat familiar with them. So these are considered to be the ancient classical texts as scriptural texts which contain the truth. And by studying those texts, you understand what the truth is at an intellectual level, and then you practice it on your own yourself to understand who you are. Okay, so that's the meaning of Swadhyaya. So Swadhyaya is to study the text to understand conceptually what these truths are, what my true nature is, who I am. And you can answer that question, who I am, intellectually at least. And then apply to yourself in the form of chanting or meditation or whatever you need to do to get a good idea of the meaning of that whole text. Okay. Now what this sutra is saying, that you can get a glimpse or knowledge and understanding of your own Ishta Devata. Now that's a term that you may not have heard before. Ishta means something that is desired. Devata is a god. Devata is a deity. Okay? Now what happens is when you do the chanting or when you do a mantra, usually the concept in India is that you pick a mantra which represents some aspect of a deity. And deities are like Shiva or Vishnu or just Ishvara, you know, anything that you identify as something higher than us, you know, and then that becomes your deity of choice. And there are mantras which are associated with each one of those deities. And then your guru, your teacher, eventually would give you a mantra for your chanting. Okay? And when you do that, that's when you are meditating with the focal point being your own Ishta Devata, your own desired deity. Okay? So what this sutra is saying that with the chanting or with the study of Swadhyaya or with the application of self-study through the understanding of scriptures, you will actually get face to face with your Ishta Devata. You will get to understand the Ishta Devata. Ishta Devata is again the deity of choice. So if you are meditating on Shiva, for example, okay, by doing this self-study based on your Shiva devotion, you will eventually come to understand, you know, the major aspects of Shiva. And they say that you can actually have a communion with the deity of choice. I don't know what that means, but the text says that it means that you will be granted the grace of that deity, whatever that means. Grace. Is there a term grace in yes. your mm-hmm. in the culture?
It means a similar thing too.
Similar?
Yeah. You're okay. Granted it, you don't deserve it, you don't ask for it, you're just granted.
You're granted that. So if Shiva is your deity of choice, then eventually you will get the grace of Shiva in some form. And also you will get to understand the concepts of Shiva that you have not understood before.
There's certain mantras that are really popular. Om Namah Shivaya.
That's a very popular mantra. Om Namah Shivaya. That's a very Om Namo Shivaya. Not Namah Shivaya. Namo Shivaya. Okay, that's a very popular mantra. And
obviously, it has to do with Shiva.
So what that means is that Namo means to bow down. And Om simply means that Om is the representative for God, Ishvara's representative. So Shiva, who represents Om, or who represents God, I bow down to that aspect of the divinity. That's what it means. I bow down to that aspect of divinity by the name Shiva, who represents Om. Same thing with Vishnu, you know, Om Namo Bhagavate, like Krishna, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. That's the name for Krishna, representing Vishnu. Krishna is the incarnation of Vishnu. Okay, so these mantras, and then there are, you know, other, when you read the scriptures, they have many other mantras. And there are long mantras, not just representing one god or one deity, but sometimes representing multiple gods and deities. So you're supposed to chant those mantras as a part of Swadhyaya. Chanting, then understanding them, and then thoroughly kind of imbibing the meaning of all those, and then eventually meditate on those, and then you can get your Ishta Devata and understand it thoroughly. Okay, so that's the meaning of Swadhyaya. Okay. Study of scriptures, Bhagavad Gita, Upanishads, Yoga Sutra, Bible, Quran, etc. Japa of Om. That's Om is the name for Ishvara, like I mentioned. So you can do Om Japa or any other Japa which is based on the ancient texts, the scriptures. Okay. Now, the next one is about Ishvara Pranidhana. Okay, so the Sanskrit is Samadhi Siddhihi Ishvara Pranidhanat. Okay, so again, Samadhi Siddhihi Ishvara Pranidhanat. Ishvara Pranidhan. Pranidhanat simply means from or by the study of or by Ishvara Pranidhana or through Ishvara Pranidhana, you can get Samadhi. You can attain Samadhi just by remembering the name of Ishvara. Ishvara Pranidhana, surrendering to Ishvara. Pranidhana means surrender. A deep sense of surrender to Ishvara.
To God.
To God. Ishvara is God. Now, I'll be spending at least two sessions on Ishvara. So, don't worry about that. You know, I'll be, because there is a very special section on Ishvara in these texts. So maybe at least one session will go in terms of understanding those sutras which are relevant to Ishvara in these sutras, in the Yoga Sutras. We'll be studying those because Patanjali has given a very special meaning to Ishvara. You know, but we'll be going through that. That will take some time to grasp and understand those sutras. But what they're saying is, through a devotion and through a surrender to Ishvara, you can get Samadhi. Okay. Now, Ishvara Pranidhana comes in a couple of different places in the sutras, if you recall. It comes in chapter 1, and where it says Ishvara Pranidhana for calming the mind. Okay. In chapter 2, it starts with Ishvara Pranidhana as a part of the Kriya Yoga, where it says Tapaswadhyaya Ishvara Pranidhana. That's the three of the niyamas which are separated out, singled out, and then listed under Kriya Yoga. Okay, to it says that, you know, we haven't come to that yet. But what
Kriya
that's...
Yoga? Hmm? Kriya Yoga?
Kriya Yoga, yeah. That's what Patanjali called it. Not the same Kriya Yoga that these people practice. So you might be confused with this.
Yeah.
That Self-Realization Fellowship, they also call their practices Kriya
yeah.
Yoga.
Yeah, so that's different than what Patanjali
said. Patanjali is very simple.
And you're going to talk about that at another time.
And another class. But if you just want to very quickly review, it's a good idea to just read Sutra number 2.12, etc.
2.1?
Yeah. 2.1. Chapter 2.1, Sutra number 1. Mm-hmm. It'll give you an idea what Patanjali means by Kriya Yoga.
Okay.
Read that loud.
Accepting pain as help for purification, study of spiritual books, and the surrender to the Supreme Being constitute yoga in practice.
That's Kriya Yoga.
That's Kriya Yoga.
Okay. So Ishvara Pranidhana comes there also. Okay, that's the number third. Okay. Tapas, Swadhyaya, and Ishvara Pranidhana are the components of Kriya Yoga. And what it says in the next sutra is that with the practice of these three, you can reduce your kleshas. Kleshas are all the afflictions, all the pains and sufferings that you go through. So why don't you read the next one also?
They help us minimize obstacles and attain samadhi.
Right. So they help us minimize the obstacles or the pain and suffering that we go through called kleshas. And that's why, you know, I will be talking about these things at some point, starting with Sutra number 1 and Chapter 2. But these three, which constitute the Kriya Yoga, when you do these as a practice, they will minimize all the kleshas and then bring you close to samadhi. And now he is emphatically saying that through Ishvara Pranidhana alone, you can get samadhi in this current sutra. Okay, so he is really emphasizing Ishvara Pranidhana. Okay, and chapter 1 also, he talked about Ishvara Pranidhana. Chapter 1, I don't remember, I think Sutra number 20-something. Chapter 1.
There's 20.
23?
I don't know.
Let's try that.
Yeah, 23.
Yeah, Ishwara.
Ishwara Pranidhanatva, right?
That's what he says, yeah.
So, there he's talking about calming the mind. He says, you know, you can calm the mind, he says, through Ishwara Pranidhana also.
Okay.
Or, so his va means or.
Bhakti yoga?
Bhakti yoga, yes. Yeah. So, in terms of these different styles of yoga, tapas is?
Pain, burning pain.
I know, but in terms of yoga, it is karma yoga.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Ishwara Pranidhana is bhakti yoga. Tapas is karma yoga. Mm-hmm. And swadhyaya, it becomes like jnana yoga. Yoga of knowledge. Because you're trying to understand the scriptures through an intellectual effort. Okay. And then eventually, sort of imbibing that into your own self through a deep self-study. So you have these three elements of karma yoga, jnana yoga, and bhakti yoga mentioned in those three words, tapas, swadhyaya, and Ishwara Pranidhana, which are the constituents of the kriya yoga that Patanjali mentions. Okay, kriya yoga. Kriya means action. Okay, so now, through Ishwara Pranidhana, samadhi can be attained. So he is really now emphasizing the elements of Ishwara Pranidhana. The reason some of the commentators spend a lot of time on this sutra is because, you know, as we know, the whole philosophy of yoga is based on the Sankhya philosophy. We have talked about that. Sankhya philosophy. Do you remember that word?
I don't remember that word.
Okay.
I don't know that word. I don't.
You don't know that word.
I think so.
No, say it again.
Sankhya?
I've heard you say it.
I've heard you say it too.
I can't remember.
What?
Another Sanskrit word.
Yeah, Sanskrit is not.
Yeah, no. Painful. Painful.
But and I think because we don't know it, it's like I can't always distinguish which word you said.
Yes.
So right. Cause some of they sound similar. And
yeah. No, but these are names now. In Sankhya philosophy, it cannot be translated.
Okay.
You cannot translate that. Mm-hmm. Like yoga philosophy, right? You cannot translate that into an English word. You have to think in terms of the word yoga. That's it. There is no way to translate that. These six philosophies that we have mentioned, there's no way to translate those. They are what they are. So there's yoga philosophy, there's Sankhya philosophy, then there are four more. Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Mimamsa, and Vedanta. There's no way you can translate them. And no book will translate them. You have to learn them as they are. I mean the names. You will not find a translation in any book. But what's important to understand is, from our perspective, that the yoga philosophy is based on a more ancient system of philosophy called Sankhya. So all the basic tenets of Sankhya philosophy were taken by Patanjali in formulating his own yoga philosophy. Now, the reason why it's an important understanding is because in Sankhya, there is no mention of Ishvara. It does not talk about God at all. It's a pure philosophical structure which does not need the mention of God. But Patanjali took over his basic system of philosophy and built his yoga philosophy, but he also introduced the concept of God into his philosophy. So the sense of devotion, bhakti yoga, which was totally missing from Sankhya, has been introduced by Patanjali into the Yoga Sutras. And most commentators, when you read this commentary on this sutra, they want to bring this point up, you know, so that you understand this subtle distinction between Sankhya philosophy and yoga, even though yoga is based on Sankhya. Okay. So that's the surrender to God, surrender to Ishvara. Again, many of the texts, they prefer to remain with the word Ishvara, because the moment you translate that as God, it brings a different image in everybody's mind. Whereas Ishvara has been defined in a very specific manner by Patanjali. So once you understand the concept of Ishvara given by Patanjali, there's no confusion really, because he has given a very proper definition of Ishvara. The moment you translate it as God, then you open the whole can of worms, because God could mean anything to anybody. So many commentators, they don't want to translate that as God at all. Okay. So I have given these sutras like 124 and 123, which we talked about earlier. I probably should not go through these now, because I'm going to spend a whole session on Ishvara sometime in the future. So rather than confusing you, I'll skip these couple of slides, bullet points. Okay. So the third bullet is important, dedicating all acts to the Supreme Lord and renouncing the fruits thereof. That's the meaning of Ishvara Pranidhana generally, which is mentioned by most teachers, that you, when you do any action, first of all, you're doing it as an agent of God, as an agent of Ishvara. You're not doing it on your own. What that means is, it's not driven by my ego. Because ego is the one which is negative of Ishvara. If I am driven by the influence from Ishvara, then ego is not in the picture. So all the actions that I'm doing are driven by Ishvara. That's number one way of looking at it. And then I'm dedicating everything that I'm doing to Ishvara. So it's done because I want to serve my Lord, my Supreme Being, Ishvara.
Selfless?
Selfless. Absolutely selfless service. And then when I do an action, whatever action I do, there is an outcome of that action. Whatever is the outcome, I offer it back to Ishvara. Whether it is success, whether it is failure, whether it is good or bad, I say, because it's something that I am doing as an agent of Ishvara, and I did my best based on my ability, this is what I get back, I'm okay with that. Perfectly happy, perfectly satisfied, contented, santosha. I have santosha. Santosha means contentment. So I'm not looking for anything more. If I didn't get what I was expecting, then I'll do something better next time. But I'm not going to be worried about all this. So that's the meaning of the devotion and surrender to God. There's an emphasis, like Karen mentioned, on bhakti yoga. Okay, bhakti yoga. Bhakti is devotion. So there's a devotional aspect here, that you are able to surrender to that supreme being called Ishvara. Okay, so those are the five yamas and five niyamas. And now we are moving on to the remaining six limbs of yoga. The next one is asana. And this one everyone should have heard from me many, many times. So the words are sthira, sukham, asanam. Sthira, sukham, asanam. Okay. Now, sthira means
steady,
firm. Something that is stable, firm, not shaking, not trembling, not moving. Those kind of things, right? That's sthira. And sukham means
comfortable.
Comfortable, which does not give you any kind of pain or suffering or discomfort or any such thing. So that's comfortable. So sthira sukham asanam. Asanam. What does the word asanam mean?
Posture.
Seat. Sitting posture. Asanam literally simply means the sitting posture, because it comes from the Sanskrit root word as. As means to sit. I know it's not the English as, but it means to sit.
I didn't know
that. That's interesting. Okay. Asana means sitting posture, or what you're sitting on or sitting in. So if you're sitting in this chair at this moment is your asana. If you're sitting on that bolster at that moment is your asana. But the posture you're sitting in also is the asana. Whatever posture you're sitting in, that also is called the asana. But the word asana simply means a sitting posture. Okay? So the obvious question comes up is, you know, why are we calling this as an asana and this as an asana and all these other things as asana? So the way to look at it is, look, Patanjali gave us these eight limbs of yoga, okay? Yamas, niyamas, etc. You sit down in asana, which is sthira and sukham, very comfortable, steady and very comfortable. And then do some pranayama, because that's the next limb. And then eventually meditate. Meditate, meditate, meditate. That's it. That's the whole crux of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Follow the yamas and niyamas. Don't violate those. Then sit down very comfortably in a posture, pleasant posture, sukham, comfortable, stable. And then do some pranayama, and then meditate. That's it. Now, when people started following that, they realized that after a few minutes, their hips would hurt, their shoulders would hurt, their back would begin to hurt, and knees would hurt, ankles would hurt, everything would hurt. So they said they have to do something. So they devised all these asanas to make the body stronger, more flexible, more durable, more stable, so that when they could sit, when they sat in meditation, they could sit there for a long period of time without having to shift their position, move their legs, all that. But then having done all this study and an understanding of this, of these all these different postures, instead of giving them a different name, they said, we'll keep the same name that Patanjali has given, asana, and we'll call these also asana. Even though literally the word asana means the sitting posture, but they continue to use the word asana for all the other postures also.
Kind of at what point in time were those?
Well, you know, they were consolidated by the Swatmarama in the Yoga Sutra, in the Hatha Yoga Pradipika.
Okay.
That's where the first.
Okay.
Available written document is available for all the yoga postures.
When was it?
This was about 1,000 years ago.
Okay.
Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, they say, are about 2,500 years old, roughly. So maybe 1,000 years after that, all these things started being developed. And actually, they must have started immediately, right after Patanjali, because people
would begin to realize.
Realize that.
Yeah.
So they must have started, but the consolidation of all the practices was given to us by Swatmarama in the Pradipika text. There he lists all these many asanas and pranayama practices and meditation practices, etc., etc. So all the practices are listed in the Pradipika text, which is about, some people say it's 14th century, some say it is 1100 after Christ, some say it is 1,000 years old, who knows. My guess is about 1,000 years old. So now asana means everything, you know, all the postures, even though the literal meaning is simply a seat or a sitting posture. That's a very important thing to know, because people mostly identify yoga with asana And that too in asana, which is all inclusive, everything. You know. So that's asana. Posture must be steady. It implies a seated posture suitable for meditation. No shaking, no trembling, comfortable. For the steadiness of breath and stillness of the mind, you need a very steady, still posture so that your breath can become calm and your mind can become calm. In Hatha Yoga asana practice, to develop a strong and flexible body resulting in comfortable and steady seated posture. Asana helps to remove the 9 impediments and the 4 accompanying symptoms. Does anybody remember the 9 impediments? Somebody wants to read that? You want to read that?
Sure.
Yeah. Vyadhi.
130?
Lethargy, disease.
Yes, lethargy, the disease.
Dullness, doubt, carelessness.
Read it loud. Read it loud.
Okay. Disease, dullness, doubt, carelessness, laziness, sensuality, false perception, failure to reach firm ground, and slipping away from the ground gained. These distractions of the mind stuff are the obstacles.
They are the obstacles to the practice of yoga. Okay, and then asana practice will help you get over these obstacles. If you practice asanas regularly, okay, then you can remove some of these difficulties. The next one is accompanied in the very next sutra. You can read that also.
Accompaniments to the mental distractions include distress, despair, trembling of the body, and disturbed breathing.
Right. 30 and 31. Okay. And we'll be talking about these at some point. These sutras a little more, just a little more in depth. Okay, so this one next is for the asana practice. How do you get to that state where it is stable and comfortable? The next sutra tells you that. So the sutra is, you want to repeat after me?
Prayatna.
Let's try it again. Prayatna.
Prayatna.
Shaithilya.
Shaithilya.
Ananta.
Ananta.
Samapatti bhyam. Samapatti bhyam. So it is prayatna, shaithilya,
ananta,
samapatti bhyam. Samapatti bhyam. That's one word actually. Samapatti bhyam is one word. Samapatti bhyam. Actually, this whole thing is one word. Ananta samapatti bhyam is one word. In Sanskrit, sometimes they join the words together and makes a very long word, but it becomes one word. Okay? So this is, the whole thing is one word actually. Prayatna shaithilya ananta samapatti bhyam. Oh, I have it. Yeah, that's wrong.
Yeah,
that's wrong. You got it.
I'm plus today. Just a
you pass your exam.
Yeah.
Let me see what it says here. Yeah. No, that's wrong. I need to fix that. She caught a mistake in the Sanskrit text.
Start.
I have spelt it as Anantya, not Ananta.
Oh, the extra N.
Okay. The Y. Y, extra Y. I have added a Y there after Ta.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah.
She read the Sanskrit part and then. Good catch. need to fix that.
So were we reading it or mimicking you when you listened to us talk?
Mm-hmm.
Were we saying it right or not?
Yeah, we said it right.
We did? Okay.
Yeah, you said it right. I was reading it right. I was reading it, saying it right, but
I
just wasn't reading it from that text there. Okay.
I think this is Satchitananda's text has it like that.
Really?
I think so. I'm missing it.
No.
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 Okay.
He took. He didn't add the other
A. I didn't add the ya there.
Okay.
See here, there's a ya there.
Oh, okay. I was looking
at the spot. That wouldn't make any sense that year, anyway. Okay, so what does that mean now? So this is a very nice sutra to understand. The word prayatna means effort, and shaithalya means to let go. So first it says to make the asana very comfortable and steady, you have to let go of the effort. So don't make any unnecessary effort. Don't allow it to hurt or don't allow it to become uncomfortable. Okay, that's the prayatna shaithalyam. Let go. Totally. Let it loose completely. Let go. And then ananta samapatti. Samapatti means samadhi or meditation. Samapatti means meditation or samadhi. Ananta means infinite, very large amount. Okay. Now, these commentators have taken this sutra and have taken out many, many meanings, different meanings of this word ananta samapatti. Okay. Because everyone has their own favorite meaning and they follow that. I have my own favorite meaning. Okay, now one of the meanings that some people have given, in the Indian system, and in the Indian folklore, you can call it, Ananta is the name of a serpent. It's a snake. It's a mythical snake who has two purposes, that snake. One purpose of that snake is that it upholds this entire universe on its seven hoods.
Seven what?
Seven hoods. It's got seven hoods. Hood is the right word, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
I
never
heard
of that word.
It's like a
cobra.
No.
Hoods.
You know the part that comes up over, you picture a big...
like a cobra.
Cobra.
Like a cobra.
Yeah.
You know
the hood?
There's
seven
hoods.
They have like the things that come out. They come out when
so
it comes
the
up.
Hood.
Yeah.
It's like a veil.
So we got seven hoods?
This snake, this Ananta, it's supposed to have seven hoods, and it is holding the entire universe on its seven hoods. And it is so perfectly stable that nothing moves and shakes. The only time it shakes, there's an earthquake.
Is this?
We don't live in California. We don't ever feel it shake.
Can I go for a stretch and say, is this related to the Kundalini aspect of the snake?
I'm coming to that.
Right.
I'm coming to that.
Right.
Okay. It's not a stretch. That's one of the interpretations given by some of the authors. Okay, so that's one interpretation. The second is this snake, Ananta, is also the bed rest for Vishnu. If you see a picture of Vishnu, he's always resting himself, reclining on this snake. And these seven hoods are the kind of the umbrella protection on Vishnu's head. You've seen that picture? Right. People from India know this image. It's a very common image. Very, very common image. Where Vishnu is sleeping on this snake, serpent, and the seven heads are protecting him. Okay? That's the second image. So what they're saying is, if Vishnu is your deity of choice, you can take this meaning and then concentrate on that. When you're sitting in meditation, before you start your meditation, get into this frame of mind where you are focusing on your deity of choice, which is Vishnu, and think of this snake as being the representative rest place for this deity.
I don't know how that's going to help.
Yeah, I'm saying I don't think I can.
This, you have to, no.
Get me to enlightenment, I don't think.
You have to grow in this culture to know what it means.
Right, yeah. So for us.
There are people in India who are extremely devoted to Shiva or Vishnu.
Yeah.
Extremely. Okay? And they know everything about these things, everything. And for them, it means a lot.
Right. Mm-hmm. So how is an American going to be able to meditate on one of
I'm coming to that.
Yeah,
when we
didn't
grow up with them.
Own.
Right.
You get to choose your own. Really.
You get to choose your own, and you get to choose the interpretation that I have, that's my favorite. I'm going to come to that at the end. Okay? All right. And the next interpretation is what Jessica was just saying. Ananta is also the name of the snake, which is Kundalini. Kundalini is represented by a snake, you know, which is coiled around itself three and a half times. Does everyone know that roughly?
What is Kundalini? I've heard that, but I don't know really.
We're not going to get into that there.
Too big of a question.
That okay. Too big. The question is simple, but the answer is too big.
Okay.
But
so this sutra has the interpretation of the snake also, not just the infinite.
Yeah, it's because Ananta is the name of that snake.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. And the moment you talk of a snake, then you get into the Kundalini aspect. So they are saying, focus your mind on that Kundalini in the beginning, on that Shakti, on that power that is residing at the base of the spine in the form of a snake, which is coiled around itself 3.5 times. I'm going to spend about 3 sessions on Kundalini.
Okay.
Whenever we are done with these Yoga Sutras, I'll spend about 3 sessions on that. That's why I didn't want to answer that question.
No problem.
Takes a while.
It's a lot to absorb.
What if you're already comfortable and quiet in your meditation?
Yeah, then if you're very comfortable and you can sit there for a very long time without any problem, then go straight into your meditation. That's it.
I can, but I mean, I'm very quiet, but I don't seem like I'm in the infinite yet.
Yeah, but that takes practice, right? If you were in the infinite, you'll probably be very close to self-realization.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't be here.
Then you'll be teaching everyone else.
That's right.
And then you'll be teaching as a realized master, not as intellectual, you know, like me. I'm only teaching from an intellectual perspective, not as a realized person. But it's great to hear these talks from a realized person, then, who has really has that feeling, that evolution.
Have you experienced that?
I think Swami Satchidananda was.
You
did get some sense that he.
So did you meet him?
Yes.
Okay.
Meet him in the sense, not shook hands with him.
Yeah.
I heard his talks, and you know, I was a part of his satsang every week.
Right. Okay.
When
did
I was
you live
there.
Up there? Did you live up in?
No, I did my teacher's training at Yogaville,
'96.
And
he was
alive at that time, and he used
died
to come.
In 2002.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He used to come and give satsang every Saturday.
Yes.
So in the evening.
Yeah, I see him on the
video.
I've seen the video.
Yeah. His satsang videos are very nice.
They have them every Saturday night if you want.
Well, you know, somebody told me that. I keep forgetting to tune in.
Yeah,
I've actually been up there and seen some of the videos because I've been to Yogaville.
They play the video nowadays.
Yeah.
On satsang days, they play the video.
Yes, they play one of his videos.
Right. And then they do some discussion and some bhajan.
Whoever guest speaker is.
Guest speaker.
And people that
they sing songs and play some music and all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
where is this?
Yogaville. Virginia, 3 hours. I go every month.
I do.
It's a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's another interpretation, that you focus on the Kundalini aspect. Or what Swami Satchidananda himself said was that you should imagine a vast expanse of space in front of your third eye. That becomes your infinite space, ananta space, and then you focus on that space. That's another interpretation. The other interpretation that I like, from my perspective, is that you become aware or you experience the whole, whatever you're doing at that time. I'm saying that, okay, let's do the warrior pose. All right? Now, in the warrior pose, as I stay in the pose, my experience is going to change from every one moment to the next. Okay? Become deeply engrossed in that experience, so deep that you become a meditator on that experience. You're absolutely meditating on it. There is no other thought in the mind except what you're feeling in your leg, in your thighs, in your mind, in your breath. That's all that you're thinking about. To the infinite level, become one with that experience of that asana, no matter what asana. If you're sitting, feel that sitting posture. Feel the touching points of the body with the floor, feel the heaviness, feel this, that, and become one with that whole experience. That's my interpretation. To me, that's a practical experience, practical approach, and then applies to what I'm doing at that time. Okay, so depending on who you read, depending on the author, commentator you read, you'll get a different perspective on this. Everyone has their own. By lessening the natural tendency for restlessness. Okay, mind free from body awareness. Meditation of endless. Ananta also translated the snake that upholds the earth, symbolizing strength and steadiness, also the Kundalini Shakti. Practice of Yoga Nidra also helps to relax. So Yoga Nidra is the deep relaxation that we do many times. If you do that a little bit before your asana practice, it might help.
A little bit before?
Before the meditation,
before
basically.
Before the meditation.
Yes. Well, when asana, we take...
Asana, yeah.
Asana means sitting posture.
Yeah. Right. I caught myself after I said it, so...
No, okay, so next one. So you want to read that with me? Tataha. Dvandva. Anabhighataha. Anabhighataha. Tataha. Dvandva. Anabhighataha. Right. Now, this is a sutra that I don't quite understand very well. Commentators don't shed a lot of light on this. And to me, it seems a little out of place, because just by practicing asana, you cannot get rid of all the dualities of life, in my opinion. You need to have a very prolonged practice of meditation before you start getting rid of dualities of life. In fact, getting rid of all dualities of life is the main purpose of yoga. And that's one of the final goals of yoga, where you can now completely eliminate any influence from the dualities of life. But that comes after a lot of meditation practice.
See, I interpret this as, like, from the one following, that if you're in a very peaceful meditation without any movement or disturbance, that you would then be undisturbed by heat or cold or, what does it say, praise or censure, profit or loss, because you're in a state of...
But that's only after meditation.
Yeah, only after meditation.
That's what I'm saying. But he's saying as a result of asana.
Oh. But isn't asana, like, isn't the asana here, like, to sit?
Sit, yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's sit, but just...
Asana
doesn't mean meditation. You're sitting, because meditation is the next limb of yoga.
Right.
Asana, pratyahara, pranayama, pratyahara, then comes the meditation limbs. And it's only as a result of meditation that you will be able to get over all the dualities of life. Heat and cold and honor and dishonor and good and bad and ugly and handsome and all that. You get to that point, in my opinion, after you have meditated for a long enough time. Not just by sitting in a comfortable posture. I mean, I just don't understand this sutra very well myself. That's all I'm saying.
And just by posture alone, you can rise above the dualities. Because the mind is under your control.
That's not past. Mind is under control only after very long and meditation.
Me too.
You know, so it's a little bit out of place, in my opinion. Again, obviously, I all I'm saying is I do not understand this.
Well, if you read it, so if you go back to 47 and read the English, by lessening the natural tendency for restlessness and by meditating on the infinite, posture is mastered. And then right after, thereafter, one is not disturbed by the dualities.
Yes, exactly.
So is he talking about meditating and posture?
Yeah, maybe. I was thinking it would be talking about meditation.
Yeah, you need to think about that, yeah.
Maybe it's just a temporary thing that you, that situation that during that time that you can maintain that time. It's not necessarily
a
body meditation.
Right.
Or it's like a transformation.
It could be. Yeah. It could be one of many things, but.
I'm peaceful when I meditate, then when I get up, may not be so peaceful.
That happens to everyone, right?
I'm lucky to get through the meditation. Just
practice, practice, practice.
Opposites are heat, cold, pleasure, pain, good, bad, etc. They all cause mental conflict. Asana is very necessary for other limbs like pranayama and pratyahara. It develops willpower necessary for undertaking long periods of meditation. That's a very important point. That, you know, when you're able to sit very comfortably with your full awareness and you have that mental willpower to sit for longer periods of meditation. Okay, so we need to think about that duality stuff a little more. I need to keep working on it. Because meditation is a separate limb of yoga. It's not a part of just sitting posture.
Yeah, I guess I'm putting this with meditation.
That's what I'm saying. You know, if you have, if you already started your meditation practice, then you've already crossed that limb of yoga called asana. Mm-hmm. Then you're into the meditation limb, which is a different thing.
Okay.
So again, you know, it's okay.
Yeah, maybe they're not also separate.
Maybe they're not also separate, that's right.
Yeah.
That's probably what it is.
They shouldn't be separate at all.
Maybe that's what it is. Mm-hmm. But it's good food for thought.
Yeah.
At least from my perspective. Okay. Now, we're moving on to pranayama. So the Sanskrit is tasmin sati.
Tasmin sati.
Shwas.
Shwas.
Prashwas yoho.
Prashwas yoho.
Gati vichheda.
Gati vichheda.
Gati vichheda.
Gati vichheda.
Pranayama.
Pranayama.
That's the definition of pranayama. Let's read it one more time. Tasmin sati. Shwas prashwasayoho gati vichhedah pranayamaha. Okay. So what does it mean? Tasmin sati means once established there, being there. That means once having been established in that firm and comfortable sitting posture, that's what that tasmin sati means. It refers to the previous sutra, being there. Shwasa, prashwasa. These are inhale and exhale, basically. Okay, shwasa is inhale, prashwasa is exhale.
So are you supposed to control how much breath you take in and be aware of that and control how much you take out all the time? You're supposed to be totally aware of that all the time? That's what he wants?
Well, let's read that first, okay? Okay. Now, again, you know, there's a word here, gati vichhedaha. That word has been interpreted and translated differently by different commentators. Okay? Now, what Swami Satchidananda is saying, that the movements of inhalation and exhalation should be controlled. That's what Gati Vichheda, according to him, means. But Vichheda means to break something. Gati is the movement. When you break the movement of inhalation and exhalation, some people have translated that as holding the breath, breath retention. That's when you break the movement of inhalation as well as exhalation. Vichheda literally means breaking something. Okay? To create a separation between two things is Vichheda. And Gati is the movement. So movement of what? Inhalation and exhalation, Shwasa and Prashwasa. So you're trying to now control the breaking of the movement of inhalation and exhalation, whatever that means to you.
So once you become aware of the space between the inhalation and the exhalation.
Yes. Not just the space between the two, but if you break the inhalation at some point, can you make it longer also? Maybe that's what it is. That's okay. That's a good interpretation. Observe the space between inhale and exhale. That's one way of looking at it. And then that space can be longer in terms of time, then it will become a full breath retention. Right? When you hold the breath, it's called kumbhaka in our practical terms. So that becomes the breath retention then.
So this, is it necessary to have to do that? I mean, some people say they pass out. Is that?
Pass out what?
They can just pass out because they've held their breath so long. You know.
Then that's not very desirable at all.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
No, not at all. Yeah, if you pass out, that's not what pranayama is.
Okay.
Doesn't
sound like you're doing it right.
Then, yeah. Okay. I've heard that happen. That doesn't sound like something I'd want to do.
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. That's never, never recommended by anybody. Pranayama is to control the prana, not to pass out. So again, the interpretation of this sutra, many commentators have interpreted it in many different ways, depending on who you read. And Gati Vichheda is the main word. Swami Satchidananda's translation is control, which is, in my opinion, not the right translation. But that Vichheda does not mean control. Vichheda means to create a hole in something, create a break in something, to cut something off. That's the word Vichheda. And Gati is the movement. So this is, you know, some understanding that I get because of the study of Sanskrit that I've had over the years, and it gives me at least some perspective on what this sutra might mean, and not just depend on Swami Satchidananda or somebody else's translation.
So your interpretation is you think it means holding the breath.
It means holding the breath, breath retention.
And the bandhas, they're the
bandhas are later, I mean, they're not a part of this whole thing. He's talking of Vichheda. Vichheda simply means holding something or breaking something.
Breaking the flow.
Yeah. And you can break it momentarily or you can break it for a long time.
So there's like a natural break between the inhalation and the exhalation.
Right.
It's there. So when you hold it, you're expanding that.
Right. Right.
Okay.
That's my interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
So breath is the gross manifestation of prana. That's the cosmic or the vital life force. And breath, usually they represent that as the link between the body and the mind. because it connects both of them together. And so once you learn how to control the prana, you can, you know, influence both the body as well as the mind. Okay? And the vehicle for prana is the pranamaya kosha. Does everyone know what I'm talking about? Pranamaya kosha.
It's one of the koshas, it's one of the layers.
One of the layers.
Consciousness, is that?
Layers of being, so to say.
Layers of being.
What are the five layers?
Anamaya.
Annamaya kosha.
Annamaya,
pranamaya next.
Pranamaya kosha.
And then manomaya.
Manamaya.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then number four. Vijnanamaya. Vijnanamaya. And number five, Anandamaya kosha. Ananda. Ananda.
Ananda.
Okay. So the Annamaya is the physical body, the physical structure of the whole human being. Physical muscles, bones, limbs, everything. That's physical body. That's the Annamaya kosha. Anna means food. So the structure of the body that is sustained by food, that's Annamaya kosha, which is this physical structure. Pranamaya kosha is sustained by prana, by the vital breath of life. Okay, so whatever is the physiological functionality in the body, that's called the pranamaya kosha. That's all the physiological function, breathing, blood circulation, circulation of everything else, digestive function, circulation of all the enzymes and assimilation of the food and elimination of food, you know, all these things. They're all a part of the pranamaya kosha at a gross level. Then you talk about the manomaya kosha, which is the mental function, mind. Mind does all kinds of stuff, thinking, willing, desiring. Ambitions happen in the mind, anxiety happens in the mind, stress happens in the mind, all that stuff is manomaya kosha. Predominantly dominated by the ego. That's the manomaya part. Because ego is a big player in that whole process. Okay? So that's the ego part. And then the manomaya kosha is the mind. And then the vijnanamaya kosha. What's that now? That's the part that goes beyond the ego. That means now you are able to access or connect with your intuition or the pure part of the intellect. So there is, so to say, an impure part of the intellect which is controlled by the ego. And there's another part, another face of the intellect which is not controlled by the ego but by the intuitive wisdom that we have deep inside us, not readily accessible because of the ego. That's called the vijnanamaya kosha. And finally, when you can transcend all these, then you're left with nothing but pure bliss and joy, which is pure in the sense that it is not alloyed with ego, it is not influenced by the ego, and it doesn't need anything. So there's no need to take a trip to Hawaii to be happy. There's no need to have a $1 million house to be happy, you know. All those things.
Ananda.
There. Hmm?
Ananda.
Ananda. Pure bliss. Joy. Innate bliss and joy. So that's a little digression about the five koshas. And then this prana is the vehicle for this pranamaya kosha. Okay? And nadis of subtle energy, that's the topic that we'll cover in the Kundalini class. Again, there's a lot to talk about that. Going to come to this later. This is from chapter 1. I just added it here because it also relates to pranayama. Let's skip that. Okay. Now, this is the next one. This is where all the parameters of pranayama are defined by Patanjali. So let's read the Sanskrit first. Bahya, Abhyantara, Stambha Vrittihi, Desha, Kala, Sankhyabhihi, Paridrishtaha, Dirgha, Sukshmaha. Sukshmaha, Sukshmaha. Dirgha Sukshmaha. It's a long one. Let's try it one more time. Bahya, Abhyantara. Why did I put Abhyantara? That's not right. I need to change that. So Bahya, Abhyantara, Stambha Vrittihi, Desha, Kala, Sankhya Abhihi, Paridrishtaha, Dirgha, Sukshmaha. Okay. Bahya means external, Bahya. Abhyantara means internal. Stambhavritti means breath retention. Stambhavritti means holding the breath. So this actually talks about holding the breath. Okay? And then Desha means physical location. Kala means time duration. And Sankhya Abhi, Sankhya is the number. How many times you want to do the pranayama. And it could be long or short, dirgha or sukshma, long, short, long. Dirgha could be mean big, long, loud, anything. Sukshma means subtle, soft, short, small, anything like that. So what are these now? These are the variables that you can add to your breathing to make different types of pranayama practices. Okay, so the different variables, all the parameters of your breathing practices have been defined by Patanjali. And then people have gone ahead and used these in many different permutations and combinations to develop multitude of pranayama practices. You know, I have a book in Hindi with me which lists about 70 some odd pranayama practices. There are many books that list many different pranayama practices.
I have one question. Stambha in the Devanagari, is it as the TH, is it a different symbol? Stambha.
Yeah, Stambha.
I thought the T is different than the TH.
H, there's no
oh, the English.
Stambha.
Stambha, you're right.
Yeah. How did another one? Wow.
That's another one.
Yeah.
See, I'm not reading those, so.
Don't let her go to any more Sanskrit classes.
I know. She's picking up really well. That's amazing.
Let her get it too much.
So I should make a note of this.
I should look through all of them and send you a note.
Yeah, that'll be even better. That'll be very good.
Yeah, because the two A's, you have two A's there, Bahya and Abhyantara. There's no two A's in the sutra listed here. There's only one.
Oh, that doesn't matter. That's how you combine words.
Oh, is that
Abhya? Yeah, Abhya, Abhyantara.
That's how you split them so that.
So it's not so long.
I think that's okay. The A
okay.
Going to
No, you're picking up very well.
Yeah, sure. The modifications of the life breath, it says it's either external, internal, or stationary. I think the external and internal sort of can understand that, but I'm not.
This translation is not accurate in my opinion. This is by Swami Sachidananda. Again, I think it's a little flawed in my understanding. What it means is this retention of the breath can be external or internal. So you can either retain the breath after having exhaled, or you can retain the breath after having inhaled.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's what it means in my understanding, because it says bahya stambha vritti and abhyantara stambha vritti. He has separated them, these three, which is not accurate from a Sanskrit point of view. So Swami Satchidananda's translation is inaccurate in my understanding. I mean, people from the ashram will laugh at me and they'll say, who the hell is he to contradict Swami Satchidananda? But that's how it is. That's what happens. Sometimes little knowledge can be dangerous, sometimes it can be helpful. Who knows?
So just talking about the different breathing exercises you can do?
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Different
pranayama exercises, which are based on these variables, these attributes of these breathing. Okay, you can vary the desha, for example, location of the breath. How, you know, location could be, again, the interpretation of location is very different from commentator to commentator. Somebody says, desha means how deep is your breath. If you put your finger here, can you feel your breath? If you put your finger here, can you feel your breath? If you put your finger here, can you feel your breath? That's one interpretation of desha. The other is location. Are you breathing from your left nostril? Are you breathing from your right nostril? Are you breathing through both the nostrils? Are you breathing through your mouth? Are you not breathing at all? Or third interpretation, where is your awareness? Is it on the third eye when you're breathing? Is it on the tip of the nose? Is it on the throat chakra? Is it on the navel chakra? That's physical location. So, like I said, different commentators, different interpretation. Everyone has their own. Desha. Kala, there's not much difference in opinion. Kala simply means the time duration. When you're breathing, how long is your breath? How long is your breath? When I'm breathing, how long is it? Is it short, fast, quick, etc., etc. And Sankhya, how many am I doing? Am I doing 500, 550, or 1,000? How many are we doing? Okay, that's Sankhya. And then, Dirgha Shukshma, is my breath very loud? Is it very long? Is it very, you know, forceful? Dirgha could also mean forceful. And Shukshma could mean subtle, not forceful at all. Very, very soft, very gentle, very, almost no sound when you breathe. So with these variables, people have devised multitude of breathing practices. Okay? In our course that we're doing, we cover maybe 10 or 12, you know, maybe a few of them. These people are attending the course these days. Okay, we cover a few. But these can be very large in number. Okay, different ratios of inhale, retention, and exhale are recommended by various authors, most common being 1-2-2 or 1-4-2, etc. Either I've just given some numbers. So inhale, retain the breath, and then exhale. The most common ratio that you will hear is between inhale and exhale, which is 1-2. Everybody talks about that. Okay, 1-2 ratio between inhale and exhale. Then the retention, you can vary depending on your capacity, how long you want to retain for.
Is retention important to do?
Yes. Because Patanjali has mentioned that. So
I know. That's
what Patanjali mentioned, it's important. If he mentions it, that means it's important. But then all these, if you read the Pradipika and all that, they give you all kinds of benefits of breath retention. There is a book from the Bihar School of Yoga. If you can, you know, get a look at that book. It's called Prana, Pranayama and something else. I forget the name total. Full name is Prana, Pranayama, and Prana Shakti. I think that's the name of that book.
Do you know who the author is?
I don't know the... I think it is... It's from the public... Publisher is Bihar School of Yoga. Bihar. Bihar. And that There's a very nice book on pranayama, in my opinion. It's one of the better ones that I have seen so far.
Is that also the ones that you said, the Pradipika?
Yes.
Yes.
That also is from the same school.
Okay.
Very good books. And the word paridrishta implies close observation or awareness of the full breathing cycle. Paridrishta, full awareness. This is another one of these very enigmatic sutras which not many people seem to explain very well. Again, the same thing. Bahya, Abhyantara, Vishaya, Akshepi, Chaturthaha. So fourth, Chaturthaha means fourth. So one was the external, internal, then the retention, etc. That was number three. And then the fourth one is Chaturthaha, is this one where it says, now, it's very hard to understand this. I don't understand this very well. It says the pranayama, which goes beyond the sphere of internal and external, is the fourth one.
So, where is it?
Now, the most commonly mentioned interpretation of this is that this retention happens on its own. So, it happens in the deepest state of meditation. You stop your breath by itself. That happens. When you're a very deep state of meditation, there's no breathing going on sometimes. That can happen. I have a cousin of mine in India, in Bangalore now. He claims that when he's in meditation, he's not breathing for the most part. And he says he sits in meditation for about 2 hours every day. And out of those 2 hours, I think he said that he maybe at least an hour or hour and a half when he's not breathing at all.
Then you say, how do you do that?
How does he know? I don't know.
Yeah, that's like, okay.
And how does he do that and live?
Well, that's what happens to yogis, they say.
Yeah.
That's what happens to yogis. I mean, there are all kinds of stories of yogis who dig themselves underground for days, and then come out alive. There are all kinds of stories there. I have a brother-in-law who is a doctor in India. He did a study in the 70s. They invited a yogi from the Himalayas, and they actually had a big chamber, and this yogi was made to lie inside the chamber. And they had all kinds of instruments and had everything attached. But this chamber was completely made devoid of all oxygen. Complete vacuum was created inside the chamber, 100%. And just to prove that there was no oxygen, they had put a couple of candles in there, and they went out immediately after they eliminated all the oxygen from the chamber. And then they had all these instruments attached to his body to monitor all his vital functions. And this yogi remained inside that chamber in a state of vacuum for 3 hours.
Wow.
This is for their study in the lab. Okay, and then he came out, and after 5 minutes, of his coming out, he opened his eyes with a smile. No problem. And his heart rate apparently had gone down to almost nothing, and his pulse rate was almost nothing. But he was alive and well. And then there are so many experiments people have done on these yogis underground and in a state of total vacuum and things like that. There's a very famous yogi, Swami Rama. His ashram is in the Poconos somewhere. He was, again, taken through a lot of these studies in the laboratory, and he allowed that to happen, and all kinds of studies. This was in the USA. Okay. So, So that is possible, but what I don't understand is the actual meaning of this sutra. Bahya Bhyantar Vishaya Akshepi. That I don't understand very well. I've tried to understand it by looking at different commentaries, and everyone kind of is hazy on this commentary, on this sutra. And all they're saying is, okay, you know, it's possible that Patanjali meant this. You know, it's called Kevala Kumbhaka. That Kumbhaka. Kumbhaka is the breath retention. And Kevala means which happens spontaneously. Okay? So it is a spontaneous breath retention that happens in your deep state of meditation. That's what most people have interpreted this sutra to mean. Not sure. Okay. And as a result of pranayama, let's read the next sutra. Tataha kshiyate prakash avaranam. Tataha kshiyate prakash avaranam. Right. As a result of the practice of pranayama, tataha means as a result of, or as from thereupon. Kshiyate means destroyed or diminished. Kshiyate. Prakash avaran. Avaranam is the cover, is the, what does it say?
Veil.
Veil. Avaranam is something that you're covering yourself with. So the veil of over the light, which normally is there, that veil is removed by the practice of pranayama. And this light, what are we talking about? This is the same light that I mentioned earlier, the light of intuitive wisdom, over which there is a veil called this avaranam. And that veil is caused by the ego in most cases. And that veil, because pranayama is so powerful, that veil is removed, so you can see the light of wisdom. Pranayama has been given a lot of importance in our yoga culture, in our yoga practices, much, much more than the asana practice. Of course, like I mentioned, the priority given in these yoga culture texts is that meditation is the most important. Next is pranayama, and then asana practice. That's the least important. Okay. In terms of priority. And finally he says that not only the veil of light is removed, but this is important. It says dharanasu cha yogyata manasaha. Dharanasu cha yogyata manasaha. Dharanasu means in dharana. Yogyata means ability. So mind's ability to go into dharana, into the first stage of meditation, is improved, so to say. Or and the mind becomes fit for dharana practice.
With proper breathing.
With proper breathing, with all the pranayama practices, the mind gets into the doorway for meditation, so to say. It enters the state of meditation. Okay? So, that's why, you know, even in my meditation classes, I always practice many of the pranayama practices as a form of dharana. And that is, it's a natural way to get into a state of meditation. You practice pranayama for some time and then you can transition to your meditation very effectively, very nicely. Okay. Now, I'm assuming most of you practice meditation, right, at home? Yeah. Tejal, you practice meditation? Not much?
No,
okay.
Just
sometimes, yeah.
Not very regular. I would like to do
more. Not regular?
No, regular.
Yeah. Yes. So once you understand that yoga literally just means meditation, then you will, you know, start believing that there should be a practice of meditation. And of course, individual, you may have limitations based on whatever family situation is there, but that's okay. But again, the effort should be to at least try and allocate some time to sit and meditate for some time. And dharana is the first stage of meditation called dharana. Dhyana and samadhi, those are the three stages of meditation. Dharana, dhyana and samadhi. So the fourth pranayama is the one that goes beyond the internal and external. And the fitness of the mind for concentration is established. All the activities of the mind are controlled by prana. And if prana is controlled, we can control the mind. That's a statement from the Pradipika. From the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, it says if you can control the breath, you can control the mind. Okay? Okay, I'm going to stop at this point today. My throat's getting dry and getting... This is a new topic, Pratyahara. We'll get into that next time.